It's very difficult to follow Dick Cooley and John Eberhardt, but I'm thankful to John for really setting a very noble mood. I'd like to state a formula, if I might, which would simplify one of the principal ideas I raised this morning. And that formula, since we don't have a blackboard, if you can just visualize it, would have R standing for resources divided by P, which would stand for population numbers. In other words, divide resources by populations. And in the natural environment, these resources divided by populations, the per capita available would be a function of the abundance of nature. Obviously, if populations increase under such a situation, there will be less per capita. And one of the solutions is either for a society to fight another and annihilate one another that way, or to stratify the society in which those who control the society should have abundance and those who have lost control would simply accept subsistence. It's quite obvious that that condition, expressed by such a simple formula, is one in which humanity has been confined for the last 10,000 years, the agrarian situation. And it's no wonder that in such a bind that the mind would invent, the very perceptive minds would invent explanations. And I'd like to connect three very significant minds of the past in relation to this formula: the mind of Malthus, the mind of Darwin, and the mind of Marx. Because I think that the concepts of Malthus, Darwin, the possibility of changing completely, let's say as the possibility, not that it has. This is where the kind of imagination that John Eberhardt is talking about could very well come into play. But with the emergence of the Einsteinian equation, all this is potentially altered to a new formula. Let me give you that, which is just as simple as the other. Put resources, again, over population numbers, and the amount of resources available per capita are a function of intelligence rather than unconscious nature. Conscious nature in the form of intelligence. I think it was fairly clear from what I said this morning that, and from what you know, of course, intuitively and practically, that intelligence now has a capacity of being infinite. If this formula is true, then all thinking which is influenced by the thinking of Malthus, Darwin, and Marx are obsolete. And I believe that this is at the basis of what we call the generation gap, and why there is such contention between the organization of society by the adults of our time and the outlook of the young who are about to take over, who are preparing and being programmed, and they resent the kind of programming that we are inflicting upon them, because we are inflicting upon them a Malthusian, Darwinian, Marxian world, and they won't accept it. Not here, nor in the so-called Marxian countries. The Marxian doctrine seems to me is obsolete in both places, and the technological evolution in our two societies have so much more in common than our political differences. Now, why? Malthus simply said, if populations increase to a certain point beyond the capacity of nature to provide them, there will be starvation. And Darwin said, the fittest will survive under such conditions, And Marx came along to bring these concepts into the early period of the industrial age and said, if there's going to be this kind of survival of the fittest, it better not be the capitalist, it better be the worker. Now, we are equally Marxian in our society by saying, well, it better be the capitalist and not the worker. And so we both are, in a sense, Marxian, although we refuse to call ourselves such. But if the formula which I presented to you, that resources over population are a function of intelligence, then there's no reason at all why those who invest and those who work, presuming that in making proper investment is not a very high level of work, should be properly rewarded. If indeed we are in a society which has the capacity for infinite production of resources, then it's perfectly possible to reward all persons, and certainly for those who are least efficient or handicapped, either culturally or genetically, our society can find fit systems of welfare to take care of them without depriving other members or undermining their standard of living. If this technological potential then is possibly limitless, we need a new social mind to deal with it. And this idea is not new or original. This is an idea which was expressed in 1904 by the historian Henry Adams. And we have not yet really caught up with the thinking of Henry Adams. Of course, he was a very adventurous, forward-looking, imaginative man. He was trying, as an historian, to find some of the underlying principles of social evolution. And to him, progress was basically a capacity on the part of man to harness energy and therefore increase deliberately his resource supply. He was aware of the discovery of radium and the fact that enormous energy could be released with a diminution of mass. In a sense, of course, that preceded the Einsteinian mathematics. It was apparent to Henry Adams, even before Einstein formulated his special theory, that mass did represent energy if it could be released. And he said, by the end of this century, by the end of the 20th century, man would have unlimited capacity to produce resources because he would have unlimited control of energy. And that this would call for, because it would be such an astonishing change from anything ever previously known, it would call for a new kind of social mind to deal with it. And if anything that I've said today about the technological potential is of any significance, it's not that these technologies will improve. We can be almost certain that they will. What is important for a society, a frontier society that has such vast potential as Alaska has, is to invent the new social mind to go with that opportunity. And one could expect on the frontier that this social mind might be invented with greater ease than it can be invented in the other states to the south, which are already so bound and tied in by the constraints of the past. Now, I want to indicate to you, I want to change the theme at this point and indicate what I think are some relatively important world events that will be relevant in these terms. There is now going on a globalization of economic institutions which are ignoring the ideological confinements that we have been accustomed to for the past decades and even beyond that under different names. And I shall begin with a very homely example. In the state of Arizona, in Tucson, the Chamber of Commerce has a program which they call the two-plant system, which it advocates throughout the country. The two-plant system works on this basis. Get an industrial operation that is going in some other state, bring it to the border, set up the design elements, the automated portions, the high engineering input sections on the U.S. side, and whatever has to be done manually by what we call skill labor, which is really routine operational labor, put that up on the Mexican side. And the closer you get to the border, the easier it is to connect them. And as they say in Tucson, why pay the wages that you'd pay in Massachusetts of more than $2 an hour on the average to an industrial plant worker when you can get the same performance in Mexico for 30 cents an hour. Now, this twin plant system is growing effectively all along the Mexican border. And what it means is that the plants previously operating in other parts of the country, when they expand or improve their hardware, find it very convenient to change location. Now, I'm not saying this because I think that this is an unfortunate occurrence. I think it is a very fortunate occurrence. But I must explain why. Because 30 cents an hour to the average Mexican is a godsend. He's been accustomed to working for 30 cents a day on a plantation, on a hacienda. And throughout the underdeveloped world, people have been working for nominal wages of that much or less, and are very lucky if they ever see it in cash. They see it in credit. So there's no way for the people of the underdeveloped world to come into the prospects that the modern technological potential offers unless there is a globalization of our industries in this manner. And I think that if you're certainly aware, I've noticed it in your newspapers, which I've been reading before I came here. And I'd like to just give you a visual example of what I mean. If you go just outside New York to Newark, New Jersey, you observe the docks of the Port of New York Authority, Port of New York, New Jersey Authority. You observe the New Jersey Turnpike. You observe the International Airport at Newark. And you observe the tracks of the Penn Central system. And then what you observe is a great transfer of cargoes from one to the other. There is a real cardiovascular system in operation there. And these cargoes are being transferred now by containerization. Last year I went down to Puerto Rico. And then it dawned on me what was really happening in terms of the information I've just given you. Puerto Rico, under the Operation Bootstrap, which was really not an Operation Bootstrap at all, because the great advantage which they have is not paying the federal income tax. And this had something to do with continental industry moving to Puerto Rico. And if you could possibly have arranged something of that sort, I think you'd have had an industrial boom here in no time. But what was happening in Puerto Rico was, and one reason they were giving up the machete for the factory, was that these new ships that are being made to carry the trailer trucks of Sealand and Seatrain by the hundreds into the Caribbean, they could carry the raw materials out of the port of New York, take them to a factory in Puerto Rico, drive in the back and unload, and drive around to the front and pick up the finished product and be back in the port of New York, New Jersey, for transport by air, rail, or highway within 1 week. Now, you know, certainly, because you, as an international port here at Anchorage, realize that this is going on worldwide. I don't know if it's occurred to you what the social implications of this is worldwide. But let me give you one more example, and then I'm certain that you will recognize the significance of this. There's a company called Computer Input in the States, which realized that girls were getting $500 a month to punch cards, take information and transpose them to tapes. That the same kind of job could be done in Bangkok, Thailand, employing girls for $50 a month. And this is perfectly simple because the computer didn't understand English, and neither did the girls in Thailand. Computer Input can pick up data from any major city in the United States, fly it to Bangkok, and bring back the programmed material within 5 days. These incidents would mean nothing if one didn't tie them together into some kind of concept of what is happening. Our economic institutions now are globalizing. There's going to be no such thing effectively as national industries or even state industries or local industries. Unless one thinks that we are the only country that's doing that, the Soviet Union is also very busily engaged in the same sort of operation. It's sometimes called foreign aid. They have built ironworks in India and improving the sugar centrales of Cuba. But what they turn around and do, of course, is immediately sign contracts for the full output. This is a rationalization using low-cost labor of the underdeveloped world and the brains, of course, of the industrial world. So what we find are two currents. A passage of the routine manual labor jobs of the industrial areas of the world, the one-third, into the underdeveloped world, and a passage of the well-educated engineer types from all parts of the world, primarily into the major cities of the industrial nations. What this means are several things of real significance, it seems to me. One, that no nation now can count, no advanced industrial nation can count on its economy or society benefiting by increases in the blue-collar work. These increases will not occur fast enough to satisfy the demands, especially in a state like Alaska, it would seem to me, of rapid immigration added to its internal growth rate. So that the conclusion for the industrial world would mean that a higher level of opportunity must be provided for every citizen. An upgrading of every individual, wherever he may be, to do a kind of work which cannot be done by the routine worker of the underdeveloped world. And I could cite to you examples, because these come out in business reports of international bankers and chambers of commerce, that the efficiency of the so-called uneducated laborer of the industrial world is equal to that of what we call the educated in the industrial world. This raises a question as to what kind of education we are giving our people in what we call the advanced states of the globe. So that in the future, one could expect that the only kind of person who would really be employable and who could secure a status within the institutional structure of American society, and I would think that that would apply to Alaska, would be of the new engineering types who come out of the professional schools, who would be able to do the kind of design work which cannot yet be done as efficiently in the underdeveloped regions. So the kind of industry which will come here inevitably to develop your raw materials will be of this very high caliber type of person, whether he's imported or whether he's produced here. And this would mean, it seems to me, an obligation to create an environment, both physical and institutional, which would measure up to the expectations of such human beings. This is a very tough task, requiring the kind of imagination that John Eberhardt was talking about. I'll quit then with this comment here. But Robert McNamara, when he was just winding up his duties in the Pentagon, spoke in Montreal in 1967, and he presented this statistic, which I think possibly had something to do with convincing him that it was time to change jobs, to go from a military suppression into economic development via the World Bank. Between 1957 and 1967, there were 164 uprisings on the part of peoples in the underdeveloped world. Now, that's more than one per government, because there were only about 82, as I recall. So it's almost an average of two per government. Of course, the governments in Latin America are practically going through a revolving door. There were only two such uprisings in the industrial nations. I think there are possibly two explanations for that. One is that the expectations of people in the underdeveloped world are not being met by sufficiently rapid urbanization to absorb them. What they are doing is leaving the feudal estates and going to the cities hoping for employment. But what we find is that the feudal minds of the dominant classes of the underdeveloped world are in no mood to really invite foreign capital of the amounts which are available in the international market into their countries for fear that they will lose control. And we all know the reactions of some of the underdeveloped countries. We've witnessed the expropriations in Peru just recently. When it appears that foreign investment is coming into a country in such a way as to threaten the controls of the former leading feudal groups. It's not likely that the people are going to dismiss the opportunity that is implicit in urban development as long as they are informed, as they are being informed now by television, that the world is not exactly like it has been presented to them before. I've had peons come up to me in Latin America and say, how are your peons at home? They obviously thought that since I could afford to travel, that I must have an estate at home with a village of machete-wielding peasants who were making it possible for me to afford world travel. Now they know, of course, I doubt whether I'd encounter that kind of question today with television being worldwide. There is then basically a contradiction, I would say, in our foreign policy, and a contradiction in the spending of the federal wealth in this country as a consequence. And I won't go into that any more than to say at this moment, because I can pick this up tomorrow and carry on to the implications for land use, which was really my purpose of coming here. The contradiction in our foreign policy, it seems to me, and this is not just a contradiction in policy, but a misinvestment of the public wealth, that in attempting, as we have in the past through the Alliance of Progress, to increase the industrialization of Latin America and therefore head off revolutionary elements, we have encouraged investment, which has only raised the aspirations of the people in those countries. But the admission of our capital investments has been valved down so that local political structures could control them. And as a consequence, there have been these uprisings. And then what we do is turn around and supply them with military aid to suppress the uprising. So what we find is we are applying funds for economic development, which, raising the aspirations of people in these countries, then calls for investment in military suppression. If you keep that up, we can spend infinite amounts of federal funds getting nowhere and aggravating the environmental situations worldwide. I will suggest then, when I pick up tomorrow, that there are better ways of spending the federal income, which at the present time, I would like to remind you, accounts for 2/3 of the public wealth. And at the present time, the federal government has almost no, I say almost because it has token obligations for the public services of states and localities. And for the level of government which absorbs now 2/3 of the public wealth to have almost no responsibility for the public environment I think lies at the heart of the distress of our cities and the incapacity of states financed as they are so poorly through sales tax and property taxes, maybe a few royalties on natural resources, to carry out the very difficult task of creating an adequate man-made environment.
Thank you, Ed. Yeah.